This gloomy and malevolent passion, I mean remembrance of injuries, is one of those that is begotten, but has no children. For this reason, we do not have much to say about it. The one who has ceased from anger has killed the remembrance of injuries, because childbearing only occurs while the father lives. The one who has achieved love has cast out revenge, but the one who nourishes a feeling of ill will amasses never-ending misery for himself. A feast of love destroys hatred, and true gifts calm the soul. However, a feast that is poorly governed is the mother of audacity, and by the window of love, gluttony jumps in. I have seen ill will shatter the chains of persistent sexual immorality, and afterwards remembrance of injuries in an incredible manner. It did not permit the broken union to be restored. What an amazing spectacle! A demon saving a demon. However, it is perhaps the work of divine providence, and not that of demons. Remembrance of wrongs is far removed from natural healthy love, but sexual immorality with ease draws close to it, just as at times lice can be observed on a bird. Be hateful and bitter towards demons, and be always at odds with your body. Your carnal nature is a self-willed and deceitful companion. The more you have concern for it, the more it harms you. Remembrance of injuries, an excellent interpreter of Scripture, the sort that adapts the words of the Spirit to its own interpretation. Let it be disgraced by the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, which cannot be recited with it. After much toiling, when you still cannot take out this thorn, you should make amends with your enemy, even if it is only by word. Then it may be that you will be embarrassed by your persistent hypocrisy towards him, and with your conscience biting at you like a fire, you will perhaps feel a genuine love for him. You will recognize that you have destroyed this vice, not only when you pray on behalf of your enemy, nor when you exchange presents with him, nor when you summon him to dine with you, but only at the point when you learn that he has suffered a spiritual or bodily mishap, and you grieve and shed tears for him as if for yourself. A spiteful hermit is a serpent hidden in a burrow, which contains a deadly venom. The remembrance of Jesus' afflictions will cure the remembrance of injuries which is embarrassed by his long suffering. Worms fester in a rotting tree, and ill will finds a home in fake humility and quiet people. The one who has expelled it has discovered forgiveness, but the one who abides with it is deprived of grace. Some, for the hope of obtaining forgiveness, take up various labors and toils, but the one who forgets injuries surpasses them. If you are able to quickly forgive, then you be forgiven lavishly. A sure sign of repentance is the forgetting of injuries. However, the one that abides with them and supposes that he is repenting is like a man who, when asleep, considers himself running. I've observed people full of resentment suggest that others forgive. Yes, and being embarrassed by their own words, they expelled this passion. Let no one look upon hateful malice as an innocuous passion, for it is able to reach even spiritual people. Step number 9. Let the one who has obtained it courageously entreat the Savior, Jesus, to deliver him from his future sins. Step 10. On defamation or slander. No right-thinking person, I believe, will argue that calumny is the child of malice and hostility. Thus, it is put next after its forefathers. Defamation is the child of malice, a subtle but at the same time crude illness. It is a leech hiding, not felt, ravaging and draining the blood of charity. It is the impersonation of love, the advocate of a polluted and stiffened heart, the destruction of purity. Some women sin without being embarrassed, while there are others who, in secret and with an air of modesty, conduct themselves in a worse way than the former. It is the same with disgraceful passions. There are many hypocritical maidens. Falseness, vice, depression, the remembrance of wrongs, thinking little of others in one's heart. They seem to suggest one thing, but have something else altogether in mind. I have listened to some people maligning, and I have admonished them. And those doing the wrong answered in defense that they were conducting themselves in this manner from love and concern for the one who they were maligning. I told them, "Quit this type of love, for otherwise you will be denouncing as a liar the one who said, 'The one who secretly defames his companion, I cast away.' If you love, then pray in secret, and do not deride the man. For it is this type of love which is well-pleasing to the Lord. However, I will not keep this secret from you, and by all means consider it, and do not condemn your enemy. Judas was a companion of the disciples of Christ, and the thief was a companion of murderers. But what a change occurred when there was a crisis. The one who desires to conquer the spirit of calumny should not assign blame to the one who stumbles, but to the demon who incited him. For there is no one who desires to sin against God, although we all sin, even though we are not compelled to do it. I knew a man who committed sin openly, but repented in secret. I judged him to be a dissolute person, but he was pure before God, having appeased him by sincere repentance. Do not consider the feelings of one who slanders his neighbor, but instead tell him, 'Cease this, my brother. I commit still worse sins daily, so how can I speak ill of him?' In this manner, you succeed in two ways. You will cure yourself and your neighbor with the same bandage. This is one of the quickest paths to forgiveness. I mean not to condemn. Judge not, so that you not be judged. Fire and water cannot mix, and in like manner, one cannot condemn others while desiring to repent. If you observe one who is sinking into sin right at the hour of his death, even then do not condemn him, for divine judgment is not revealed to people. Some have descended into terrible sins publicly, but have done even greater good works in secret, so their accusers were fooled, seeing smoke rather than the sun. Hear me. Listen, all you judgers of other men. If it is correct, as it truly is, that with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, then with the sins we condemn our neighbor, carnal or spiritual, we will certainly sink into them ourselves. Those who are quick to strictly judge the sins of their neighbor sink into this problem because they have not yet achieved a regular and careful remembrance of their own shortcomings. For if one could perceive his own sins precisely, without the curtain of pride, he would concern himself with nothing else while he lived, seeing that even if he were to live 100 years, he would not have time enough to grieve over his sins, even if he were to see the entire river Jordan pouring forth his tears from his eyes. I have seen that type of grieving, and I did not discover in it even the slightest bit of condemnation. The demons, who are killers, thrust us into vice, and if they are unable to achieve this, they make us condemn those who are sinning, in order that they stain us with the very charge with which we are condemning others. This is a sign of those that are spiteful in condemning. They are full of a hateful spirit, and with delight, and without it bothering them, they defame the instruction, or business, or accomplishments of their neighbor. I have observed people caught up in the worst sins in secret, and in apparent purity, they have severely criticized those who have slightly stumbled in the open. To pass judgment on others is a reckless assumption of divine power. To condemn another is the destruction of one's soul. Pride without any other vice can destroy a man, and in the same manner, if we have taken the habit of condemning, we can be completely destroyed solely by this. For truly, this is what condemned the Pharisee. A skilled grape picker who consumes the ripe grapes will not begin with collecting unripe ones. A generous and rational mind takes attentive care of the virtues it sees in others. But the idiot seeks flaws. Of these it has been said, they have sought out iniquity and perished in the search. Do not judge, even when you observe something with your own eyes, for many times they are tricked. The 10th step, the one who has conquered it, is the one who exercises love or grieving. Step 11, on loquaciousness and stillness. In the previous chapter, we wrote concisely on just how hazardous it is to be judgmental, and how this sin sneaks into the hearts of people that appear to be very spiritual. We also wrote how it is blessed to put oneself under the rebuke and reproof of the tongue. Here we must demonstrate the root cause of this sin, and give a report on the mode of entry, or rather, exit. Gregariousness is the throne of pride, which delights itself in showing off. To be talkative is a mark of ignorance, a gateway to slander, a leader to joking, a slave of untruth, the destruction of remorse, the author of depression, the forerunner of sleep, the dissolution of memory, the ruin of vigil, the cooling of zeal, the dimming of prayer. Intentional stillness is the mother of prayer, a calling back from imprisonment, a preservation of fire, a director of the mind, a vigil against enemies, a jail of sorrow, a companion of teardrops, a powerful remembrance of death, an artist of correction, a busybody with judgment, an assistant to distress, an enemy of freedom to speak, a friend of quietness, an enemy of the desire to instruction, an increase of understanding, an author of meditation, secret progress, unseen rising. The one who has become mindful of his vices has mastered his tongue, but a gregarious person has not yet understood himself as he should. The companion of stillness draws close to God, and by speaking with him privately, he is enlightened by God. Jesus' silence made a disgrace of Pilate, and by a man's silence, pride is overcome. When Peter spoke a word, he grieved bitterly, because he forgot the one who said, "I said I will be mindful of my ways, that with my tongue I do not sin." Also the other who said, "A fall from on high to the earth is better than a trip of the tongue." I have no desire to write many things on this topic, even though the trickery of the passion would like me to do so. But once I heard from someone who questioned me about stillness. I told him that chattiness is certainly the offspring of either a poor, lazy setting and habit, because the tongue requires discipline like the rest of the body, or, especially in the case of ascetics, chattiness is rooted in pride and, at times, gluttony. This is the reason why many who check the stomach through violence are able to easily bridle the tongue and its loose lips. The one who is concerned with his own death reduces his use of words, and the one who has received spiritual grief avoids chattiness like fire. The one who has fallen in love with stillness keeps his mouth shut, but the one that enjoys roaming about is pushed out of his cell by this passion. The one who understands the aroma of fire from up high flees from conversation with men like a honeybee from smoke. For the bee is driven back by smoke, while a man is delayed by company. There are few who can hold water without a bucket, and still fewer who can control an unrestrained tongue. Step 11. The one who has conquered it has smitten a variety of evils. Step 12. On lying. Fire is the child of flint and steel, and lying is the child of a loose tongue and jesting. Falsehood is the ruin of love, and perjury is the rejection of God. Let no one with good morals suppose that the vice of lying is a trivial subject, for the All-Holy Spirit brought a terrible verdict against it above all other sins. "If you will destroy all who tell a lie," said David to God, "what will they endure who attach a pledge to a lie? I have observed those who pride themselves on their ability to lie, and arousing laughter by their joking and nonsense, have pathetically destroyed, in those who listen, the practice of lamentation. When demons observe that, right from the start, we plan to stay aloof from the droll chatter of the leader, as from a disease, then he tries to ensnare us with two ideas, suggesting, "Do not insult the leader," or "Do not seem as though you love God more than them." Depart. Do not hang around, or at the hour of prayer their jokes will reappear in your thoughts. And not only flee, but devoutly trouble the poor company by bringing their notice to the remembrance of death and the final judgment. For it may be profitable for you to be stained with some pride if you are to help others. Hypocrisy is the mother of falsehood, and often its aim. Some would define hypocrisy as a reflection on lying, and the author of lies which has a terrible pledge caught up in it. The one who has achieved the fear of the Lord has given up lying, having inside himself an incorruptible judge, which is his conscience. We observe certain measures of injury from the various passions, and this is truly the case with falsehood. There is one judgment for the one who lies because of a fear of chastisement, and quite another for the one who lies when there is nothing to fear. One will lie for the mere lewdness of it, and another for the delight it brings. Another does it to make those standing around laugh, and another to ensnare his brother and do him harm. Lying is destroyed through the harsh punishment of the director, and finally will be brought to ruin by much weeping. The one who allows himself to lie does so with the excuse that it is out of concern for others, and sees the ruin of his soul as charity. The author of lies makes it seem as though he is imitating Rahab, saying that through his own ruin, he is saving others. When we have purged away lying, then we can use it, but solely with fear and only when it is truly needed. A baby does not understand lying, and neither does a soul that has been purged of evil. The one who is drunk from wine cannot help but speak the truth on every matter, and he who is drunk with remorse will not lie. Step 12. He who has ascended to it has received the root of all graces. Step 13. On despondency. As we have stated many times before, despondency is the first child, and many times one of the offshoots of chattiness. Despondency is laxity of the soul, a slackening of the mind, a disregard of asceticism, disdain for one's oath. It is a blessing for those in the world. It charges God for being pitiless and devoid of concern for humanity. It is listless during psalmody, feeble in prayer, obstinately stuck on performing ministry, determined to do manual work, apathetic to obedience. The one who is subject to obedience does not understand despondency. Rather, he accomplishes spiritual tasks by sensory ones. Despondency is at odds with communal life. However, she is a close, ever-present friend of the hermit. She will never depart from him until his departure, and struggles with him every day until his end. She smiles when she sees a hermit's cell. She sneaks up and settles close by. In the morning, a physician will visit patients, but despondency drops in around noon. Despondency is an excuse for being hospitable. She asserts that through manual work, charity could be distributed, and she insists that we earnestly call upon the sick, bringing to mind him who said, "I was sick, and you visited me." She gives us the idea to depart and visit those in despair and the faint-hearted, and brings one faint-hearted man to be the solace of another. She reminds those who are caught up in prayer of their required chores. And cruel as she is, she provides every possible excuse to pull us away from our prayer as with a bridle. At the third hour, the demon of despondency creates trembling, migraines, and even weeping. At the ninth hour, the ailing one strengthens himself. And when the meal is ready, he hops out of bed. But at the time of prayer, again his body becomes weak. He starts to pray, but he is overcome with sleep and rips up his petitions with ill-timed yawning. For each passion, there is a corresponding virtue which can destroy it. However, despondency is generally the death of the monk. A brave soul revives his expiring mind, but despondency and laziness fritter away all its wealth. Seeing that despondency is one of the principal 8 vices and perhaps its most severe, let us reckon it with the other vices. However, let us put forth this. When there is no singing of psalms, then despondency does not show its face, and when the hourly office is complete, the eyelids open up. The spiritually forceful ones shine forth during the time of despondency, for it produces a multitude of crowns for the monk struggling with it. Look, and you will see that if you stand up on your feet, despondency will struggle with you. But if you remain seated, it will advise you to recline, and then to rest against the wall of your cell. Then it induces you to look out the window by making various noises and footsteps. He who laments knows nothing of despondency. Let this oppressor be chained up by the remembrances of your shortcomings. Let us attack him by means of manual work. May he be dragged to the tribunal by the remembrance of the coming blessings. And let him be strictly examined when he is set before the court. Reveal to me, you spineless wandering fool who gave birth to you. What are your children? Who are your enemies? Who will bring you to ruin? And despondency, under coercion, may be imagined to answer, "With those that are sincerely under obedience, I have nowhere to abide, but with those who provide a dwelling place for me, I reside quietly. I have a multitude of mothers, sometimes indifference of the soul, sometimes neglect of heavenly things, at times undue difficulties. My children who dwell with me are wandering, disobedience to one's director, forgetting the eventual judgment, and at times reneging on an oath. My enemies, who have now chained me, are singing psalms and manual work. My opponent is the remembrance of death. Prayer, with an expectation of coming blessings, is my complete destruction. Who begat prayer? Ask her. This is the 13th triumph, The one who has truly achieved it has become skilled in goodness. Step 14. On the boisterous, yet evil Lord, the belly. We have been struggling with ourselves in everything which we have discussed, and this is particularly so when we speak about the belly. For I doubt if anyone can free themselves of this Lord before resting in their tomb. Gluttony is the belly's hypocrisy, because when it is gorged, it protests of scarcity, and when it is full and close to bursting, it complains that it is hungry. Gluttony is the master of garnishes, the origin of tasty dishes. You plug one spurt, and it appears somewhere else. You plug that, and another one appears. Gluttony is an illusion of the eyes, which takes in moderation, but desires to consume everything immediately. Being gorged with food is the father of sexual immorality, but death of the belly is the instrument of chastity. The one who plays with a lion many times tames it, but the one who cherishes the body will make it ever more reckless. The Jew delights on Sabbath days and at feasts, and a gluttonous monk rejoices on Saturdays and Sundays. He counts down the days until Easter, and he readies his food many days beforehand. The servant of his stomach carefully plans out what foods he will rejoice in at the feast, but the servant of God meditates on the graces he will be honored with. When a stranger visits, the servant of the belly is full of love on account of gluttony alone, and he thinks that laxness for himself is purely for the comfort of his brother. When there are others present, he supposes it is permissible for him to consume wine, and considering it best to hide his virtue, he ends up a slave of the passion. Many times, pride opposes gluttony, and they argue with each other for the miserable monk as if for an acquired slave. The one will encourage him to take it easy, while the other suggests that he should let his virtue be victorious. The discerning monk will reject both, at the proper time, removing each passion with the other. So long as the body is carnal, let us be moderate at all times in all places. When it has been mollified, which I think is impossible for the living, then we should hide our achievement. I have observed old priests beguiled by demons on feast days, allowing young men who were not their disciples to partake of wine and everything else. If those who make such allowances are well attested in the Lord, that is, they are spiritual, then may we also allow ourselves their liberties. However, if they are careless, let us give no consideration to their permission, particularly when we are caught up in the heat of the battle with our carnal nature. When Evagrius was afflicted by an evil spirit, he imagined that he was the wisest of monks both in mind and deed. However, the miserable man was misled and became the most idiotic man in many regards. For he said, "When we long for a variety of foods, then restrict it to bread and water." To give this instruction is like telling a child, "Ascend the full ladder in one step." And so, discarding this rule, let us say, "When we long for a variety of foods, it is better to ask what is appropriate for the body's nature." So, let us also use trickery when struggling with our crooked enemy. And barring a particularly hard conflict, let us first restrict our intake of fatty foods, and then from warming our food, and only after this from those things which make our food pleasant. If possible, allow your stomach to have satisfying and easily digestible food, so as to gratify its unending hunger by sufficiency, so that we be rescued from too much desire as from a disease by quick digestion. If we examine the issue, we will discover that many of the foods which inflame the belly also inflame the body. Mock the demon who, after your meals, suggests you should eat your next meal later in the future, for tomorrow at the ninth hour he will modify the plan of the previous day. One type of moderation is proper for those whose behavior is exemplary, and another type for those who are weak. For the first, a motion of the body is an indication for the need of restraint, but the latter have such motions regularly being afflicted by them until their death. The first desire to keep their mind at peace, and the latter entreat God by spiritual mourning and grief. Those who are perfected find their joy and comfort in possessing dispassion over all things. The ascetic warrior delights in the heat of the struggle, but the slave to the passions delights in the feast of feasts, Easter, Pascha. The glutton dreams solely of food and treats, but the mind of the one who grieves dreams only of judgment and punishment. Control your belly before it controls you. Then you will be confident in your ability to keep yourself in check with the help of disgrace. Those who have fallen into this terrible hole understand what I have said, but those who are eunuchs have not encountered it. Let us cut back on our belly by the remembrance of the future fire. For there are some who were slaves of their belly and have severed their organs, and they perished in a double death. If we investigate this subject, we will discover that it is the belly alone which is the source of all human shipwrecks. The mind of one who fasts prays solemnly, but the mind of an unrestrained person is glutted with unchaste idols. Satisfaction of the belly dries the fountain of tears, but when the belly is dry, it produces these waters. He who delights in his stomach and desires to vanquish the spirit of sexual immorality is like one who attempts to extinguish a flame with oil. By being frugal with the stomach, the heart is made humble. However, by satisfying the belly, the mind becomes arrogant. Keep a guard over yourself at morning, midday, and during the hour before partaking of food, and you will understand the benefit of fasting. In the morning, the mind jumps and chases one thing after another. When the sixth hour of the day draws near, it settles down, and by the time the sun sets, it is completely calm. Limit your belly and you will no doubt secure your mouth, because the tongue is empowered by a surfeit of food. Battle with all your strength against your belly and hold it back solemnly. If you work a little, the Lord will quickly labor with you. Leather wineskins can hold much more liquid if they are flexible, but if they are neglected, they will not hold as much. He who overburdens his belly with food swells his innards, but the one who battles with his belly makes it smaller. When the inside is contracted, then we cannot consume as much, and in the future, we will naturally become fasters. Many times, thirst is overcome by thirst. However, it is difficult or impossible to overcome hunger with hunger. When the belly overtakes you, control it with work. But if this is not possible due to illness, battle against it with vigil. If your eyes become weighty, do manual work. But if you are not sleepy, do not do manual work, because it is impossible to fill the mind with God and mammon, which is to say, God and manual work. Understand that many times a demon dwells in the belly and does not permit a man to be satiated, even if he has consumed all Egypt and swallowed the whole river Nile. And once he has partaken of food, this defiled spirit departs and sends instead the spirit of sexuality, describing to him our state of being and saying, seize him, for when the belly has been filled, he will not be able to withstand you. With a smile, the spirit of sexuality arrives, and having chained us up hand and foot with sleep, does with us everything he pleases, polluting the soul and body with filth, dreams, and discharges. It is astonishing to behold the spiritual mind polluted and overshadowed by the carnal lusts, and likewise the immaterial spirit cleansed and purified by clay. If you have made a vow to Christ to travel the straight and narrow path, control your belly, for by satisfying and expanding it, you are breaking your oath. Take heed, and you will hear him saying, "Broad and wide is the path of gluttony that leads to the ruin of fornication, and there are many who enter through it, because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the path of fasting that leads to a pure life, and there are few who enter by it." The ruler of the demons is the fallen Lucifer, and the ruler of the passions is gluttony. When you sit at a table that is overloaded with food, think of the grave and judgment, because even with this you will only slightly control this passion. In tasting of your drink, always bring to mind the vinegar and gall of your Lord, and you will no doubt be either moderate or you will groan and make your mind humble. Do not be tricked, you will not be saved from Pharaoh, and you will not behold the heavenly Passover unless you regularly consume the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread. For the bitter herbs are the constraint and toil of fasting, and the unleavened bread is the mind that is free of pride. Let it be joined to your very breath, the words of him who said, "But I, when demons vexed me, clothed myself with sackcloth and humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer cleaved to the bosom of my soul." Fasting is a struggle against nature, and the removal of all that stimulates the palate, the inhibition of lust, the excision of evil thoughts, liberation from dreams, purity in prayer, the radiance of the soul, the defense of the mind, liberation from blindness, the gateway of remorse, humble sorrow, joyful remorse, a break from speaking, an agent for stillness, a watch for obedience, alleviation of sleep, health of body, a means to dispassion, a clearing of sins, a door to paradise and its joy. Let us inquire of this enemy, or indeed this prince of our missteps, this gateway of the passions, this stumbling block of Adam, this destruction of Esau, this ruin of the Israelites, this disgrace of Noah laying naked, this deliverer of Gomorrah, this rebuke of Lot, this destruction of the sons of Eli, this leader to corruption. Let us inquire from him. Where was he born? Who are his children? What defeats him? And who is able to crush him? Tell us, torturer of all humans, who has purchased everyone with the money of greed, how did you get entry to us? After you come, what do you normally generate? And what is the path of your departure? Gluttony, disturbed by these rebukes, raging in a fury against us and frothing at the mouth, answers, why are you, who are my subjects, overcoming me with rebukes? How is it you are attempting to put distance between us? I am chained to you by your very nature. The gateway to me is the very matter of food. The occasion of my insatiability is regular practice. The cornerstone of my vice is repeated habit, apathy of soul, and forgetting death. How do you propose discovering the names of my children? If I enumerate them, they will be more than the sand of the shore. However, I will tell you at least the names of the firstborn among my beloved children. My firstborn son is the agent of sexual immorality. After him is hardness of heart and then drowsiness. From me comes an ocean of evil thoughts, waves of dirt, depths of impurity that are unknown and lack names. My daughters are sloth, chattiness, close association in speaking, joking, flippancy, disobeying, a hard neck, being difficult, talking back, insensibility, bondage, pride, vainglory, arrogant boasting, after which comes impure prayer, distracted thoughts, and many times sudden misfortune, which is caught up with depression, the most vile of all my daughters. The remembrance of wrongs hinders me, but does not overcome me. The remembrance of death is always against me. But there is nothing coming from men that will bring me to ruin. The one who has the Comforter abiding in him prays to him in opposition to me, and the Comforter, when entreated, does not permit me to behave passionately. But those who have not partaken of his gift without fail seek their comfort in my sweetness. The mastery over this sin is a brave one. He who is capable, let him go quickly to dispassion and to the highest level of purity. Step 15. On incorruptible chastity and purity, which the corruptible achieve through labor and perspiration. That raging, mad Mistress Gluttony has just told us that her child is conflict against bodily purity. And this should not astonish us, since that forefather of old, Adam, teaches us this as well. Because if he had not been conquered by his belly, he would have remained ignorant as to the existence of a wife. This is the reason why those who abide by the first commandment do not succumb to the second transgression. And they remain the children of Adam, being ignorant of what became of Adam after his fall. However, they are brought a little lower than the angels, being under the curse of death. And this has been done to stop evil from becoming immortal, so says the one who is called the theologian. Chastity means that we clothe ourselves with the angelic nature. Purity is the long sought after dwelling place of Christ in the heaven on earth of the heart. Innocence is the supernatural rejection of nature, which implies that a mortal and corrupt body is struggling with the heavenly spirits in an amazing way. The one who is pure casts out love with love and is able to quench the carnal flame by the spiritual fire, the Holy Spirit. Purity is the word that is present in all the virtues. The one who is chaste, even when asleep, has no motions or changes of any sort in his body. The one who is chaste has regularly achieved perfect indifference to variation in bodies. The order and the measure of complete and total purity is to be equally administered to both animate and inanimate beings, rational and irrational. No one who is fully exercised in purity should credit himself with its achievement, because it is impossible for someone to overcome his own inclinations. When one has overcome nature, it should be understood that this is the work of the one who is beyond nature itself. For with certainty, the weaker yields to the stronger. The start of purity is the denial of having any association with evil thoughts and dreamless discharges. The middle of purity are motions from in surfeit of food, but without involving dreams and discharges. The final state of purity is the mortification of the body after the mortification of evil thoughts. Blessed indeed is the one who has obtained sincere apathy to every body, color, and beauty. It is not the one who has preserved his clay unpolluted that is chaste, but the one whose members are subordinate to his soul. Excellent is the one who is able to continue at liberty from passion even when touched, but still more excellent is the one who is untainted by sights, and who has overcome the fiery flame kindled by the beautiful things of the world by reflection on the beautiful things of heaven. The one who chases off this mongrel by prayer is like someone struggling with a lion. The one who tames it by his struggle is one still chasing his enemy. But he who has finally removed its appeal, even though he still has his carnal nature, is like one who has already risen from the grave. If the mark of sincere chastity is to be indifferent to dreams when sleeping, then it is truly a sign of sensuality to be liable to discharges from such thoughts when awake. The one who struggles with this enemy by bodily toil and sweat is like the one who has bound his enemy to a withered branch. However, the one who struggles against him with moderation, vigil, and alertness is like one who puts a leash on him. He who resists him by humbleness, freedom from anger and thirst, is like who has destroyed his adversary and buried him in the sand. And when I say sand, I mean humility, for it yields no grain for the passions but only dirt and ashes. One is able to keep this torturer chained by conflict, another by meekness, and another by a heavenly revelation. The first is like the morning star, the second is like the full moon, and the third one is like the fiery sun. They all have their abode in the heavens, and from the morning dawn comes sunlight, and in the sunlight the sun dawns. So too, with what has been written, we can ponder on it and bring new things to light. A fox feigns being asleep, and the body and demons feign innocence. The first do it to mislead a bird, the latter to ruin a soul. Over the course of your life, never trust your body, and do not depend on it until you are present before Christ. Do not rely on temperance never to stumble. The one who never ate was expelled from heaven. There are wise men who have correctly defined renunciation, writing that it is violence to the body and a battle with the belly. With novices, stumbles often occur due to luxury. With intermediates, it occurs because of pride, and also from the same reasons that cause beginners to fall. But with those that are drawing near to perfection, it is from judging their neighbor alone. Some have lauded those who are eunuchs by nature, since they are saved from a martyrdom of the body. However, every day I praise those who have made themselves eunuchs by cutting off their evil thoughts as though with a sword. I have observed people who have stumbled involuntarily, and I have observed people who desire to fall but cannot. I pitied the latter all the more than those who stumble every day, because they long for foul odor even though they are impotent. The one who falls is worthy of pity, but even more pitiable is the one who causes another to stumble, since he is responsible for both, and he bears the burden of the pleasure enjoyed by the other one as well. Do not suppose you can defeat the demon of sexual immorality by debating with him, because with physical nature on his side, he has the superior argument. The one who has committed himself to struggle against his carnal nature and overcome it by himself fights in vain. Because unless the Lord wrecks the house of the body and builds the house of soul, the man who longs to destroy it has kept vigil and fasted in vain. Bring to the Lord the frailty of your nature, fully admitting your own inability, and you will obtain, without even knowing it, the grace of chastity. In those who are sensual, as a certain person who had experienced this passion personally related to me after he conquered it, there's a sense of a certain kind of love for creatures, and a sort of immodest and heartless spirit, which publicly asserts what it feels in the senses of the heart. The spirit engenders a sense of physical hurt in the heart, violently as if from a burning stove. As a consequence, the one suffering does not fear God, scorns the remembrance of punishment as if nothing, disregards prayer, and while in the very act looks upon the body as though it were a lifeless corpse or stone. He is like a person that is out of his mind, in a stupor, forever drunk with longing for bodies, rational and irrational. And if the days of this spirit were not reduced, not a single life would be saved, arrayed as it is with this body of clay, mixed with blood and dirty water. How could this be? For everything which is created desires insatiably that which is like it. Blood longs for blood, the worm yearns for a worm, clay for clay. Does not the flesh also yearn for flesh? But those of us that check our nature and long instead for the kingdom attempt various schemes to trick this enemy. Blessed are those who have not fallen into the struggle portrayed above. Let us pray that we may forever be saved from such a struggle, because those who fall into the ditch we have described fall far beneath those who are ascending and descending by means of the ladder. To climb out of such a ditch and to merely reach the start of the ascent requires them to undergo much perspiration and intense asceticism. We should ponder on the issue of whether our spiritual foes each have their own duty to fulfill when they are set in battle array against us, just like in a war. Amazingly enough, we find they do. When I meditated on those who were tested, I saw that there were stumbles of differing severity. The one who has ears to hear, let him hear. The devil often has the practice when battling with ascetics and those dwelling in solitude of employing all his zeal, all his wiles, all his trickery, all his skill and aim to attack them by unnatural ways and not only through what is natural. There are ascetics who meet with women and are not tempted through lust, and they have at times thought of themselves as blessed, not understanding miserable things, that since there was a worse fall prepared for them, the lesser one was not needed. I suppose that our vile killers have the practice of overwhelming and enticing us, feeble creatures with vices against our nature, for the following reasons. 1, that we may have ample means of stumbling. And 2, that we may get a more severe punishment. What we have described was discovered by personal experience, by one who had earlier been in charge of donkeys and had been delivered over to the wild donkeys and was horribly disgraced. This occurred even though he had earlier been fed with bread from heaven, but then was dispossessed of this blessing. And what is perhaps most amazing is that following his repentance, our originator, Abba Antony, after sorely lamenting, said about him, "An excellent pillar has fallen down." But that sage hid the nature of the fall, for few understand that sexual immorality of the body is possible even without relations involving another body. There is present in us a type of death and a terrible sin, which is always carried about inside, particularly during our younger years. However, I dare not to speak about these things, for my hand is constrained by the one who said, "The things which are performed by them in private are disgraceful to speak, write, or hear about." This, my beloved enemy, the flesh, and yet not mine alone, was described of as death by Paul. Who will save me from this body of death? Another theologian calls it a passion-loving, servile, and nocturnal foe. At one point I wanted to know why it was described by such names. If the carnal nature is death, as we stated earlier, whosoever overcomes it surely will not die. But who is the one that will live and not taste death in his corrupt flesh? I request that you ponder on this question. Which person is better? The one who dies and then after rises again, or he who never dies? Those who praise the latter are duped, for Christ died and rose. However, the one who praises the first suggests that for those who fall, or rather die, there is no need of despair. So long as grief and anguish are present, we will not give ourselves over to any additional vices. However, when grief and anguish are extinguished, then the adversary speaks to us again about the mercy of God. The Lord, who is incorruptible and incorporeal, delights in the chastity and purity of our body. However, there is nothing which so delights the demons, some say, as the foul smell of sexual immoral behavior, and no vice brings them so much joy as the corruption of the body. Chastity means that we clothe ourselves with the likeness of God as much as is possible for a human. The mother of all sweetness is earth and water, and the mother of purity is stillness and obedience. Detachment of the body is achieved by stillness and has many times been upset by intercourse with the world, but what is achieved through obedience is sincere and secure everywhere. I have observed arrogance lead to humility, and I call to mind the one who said, "Who has known the mind of the Lord?" The stone and the fruit of pride is a fall, but many times a fall is an opportunity to be made humble for those who desire to use it for their benefit. The one who desires to conquer the demon of sexual immorality with gluttony and gorging is like a man who tries to extinguish a fire using oil. The one who tries to end this war through moderation alone is like a man who has the notion of evading the open sea by swimming with only one hand. Join a humble nature to moderation, because if one lacks the first, the latter is worthless. The one who sees that a passion is overcoming him should begin taking up arms to do battle with this vice, particularly if the enemy is a local one. Because if this passion is not brought to ruin, we cannot achieve any gain from overcoming the other passions. Having killed this Egyptian, we will surely perceive God in the bush of humility. When being tempted, I have sensed that this wolf was creating inexpressible gladness, weeping, and comfort in my soul, but it was all fake, so I naively thought I was receiving fruit from this and not injury. All other vices that one does are outside the body, but the one who gives himself over to impurity defiles his own body. This is surely due to the fact that our very flesh is stained by defilements, which do not occur with other vices. I would like to inquire, why with all the other sins we speak of them as stumbling, but when we learn that someone has been involved in fornication, we say with remorse, "Such and such has fallen." A fish quickly eludes a hook, and a carnal soul flees solitude. When the devil desires to bind two people to one another with a disgraceful bond, he labors on the dispositions of the two and then kindles the flame of lust. Those who are given to sensuality will often appear compassionate, merciful, and inclined to remorse, while those who are concerned with purity often do not appear to have these graces in the same measure. A certain educated man once asked me a weighty question: "What is the most serious sin, apart from murder and apostasy?" And when I replied, "To sink into heresy," he inquired, "Why is it then that the Catholic Church accepts heretics who have genuinely anathematized their heresy and deems them worthy to receive the mysteries? But the one who has fallen into fornication is not readily accepted, even though he admits and disowns his sin. For the apostolic constitutions command that he be barred from the mysteries for several years." I was confounded by this question, and it continues to baffle me. In discerning between joys that we feel while singing psalms, let us study, meditate on, and watch what approaches us from the demon of fornication, and that which proceeds from the words of the Holy Spirit and from the grace and force within them. Young man, do not fall short in knowledge of yourself. I have observed men pray with all their being on behalf of their loved ones, who really were simply doing so under the impulse of the spirit of fornication. But they supposed they were acting in fulfillment of the law of love. The body is polluted by touch alone. Nothing is so hazardous as this sense. Remember the one who covered his hand with his cassock when he was about to bear his ill mother, and mortify your hand to material and immaterial objects, both with your own body and another's. I suppose that one should not refer to anyone as a saint in a true sense until his body is changed into pure holiness, if such a change is possible at all. When we are reclining on our bed, let us be particularly wary and alert, because at that point our mind battles with the demons outside of our body, and if it is carnal, it quickly becomes a deserter. Ever have the remembrance of death and the repetition of the Jesus prayer with you as you go to sleep, and let them remain with you when you rise. You will find nothing else as good as these aids when you sleep. Some suppose that conflict and discharges during sleep only come from eating, but I have seen people who are gravely sick and fast severely also given over to these forms of corruption. One time, I inquired from one of the most skilled and honorable monks concerning this, and the holy man described it to me quite clearly. Discharges while we sleep, said that excellent man, are from a surfeit of food and from a lax life. They also happen because of our arrogance, when we take pride that we have not had these discharges for some time. They also come from condemning our neighbor. The last instances, he continued, can even happen to those who are ill. But it may be that all three can happen. If anyone does not see any of these reasons in himself, he is blessed to be free from passion. But if this still occurs, then it happens purely from the envy of the demons, and God permits it for a period of time, so that, after an innocent accident, he will receive true humility. No one should get into the practice of meditating during the day on the visions seen while sleeping. For the goal of the demons in suggesting this is to pollute us while we are awake by having us dwell on our dreams. Again, let us listen to another trick of our enemies. In the same way that rotten food brings about sickness in the body after a period of time or several days, so this occurs with those things that corrupt the soul. I have observed those who have surrendered themselves to a lax life and do not immediately sense the attacks of their foes. I have observed others talk and share meals with women and have absolutely no evil thoughts. But then they were tricked and incited to be lax and to suppose they were secure and at peace. Then, without warning, they fell into ruin in their cells. Oh, the carnal and spiritual ruin that befalls us when we are alone! The tempter knows this full well, but the one who is not tempted need not understand. During these circumstances, the best remedies for us are sackcloth, ashes, standing throughout the night, hunger, wetting the tongue only in measure when thirsty, living in the tombs, and most importantly, having a humble of heart and taking advantage, if one is available, of a spiritual director or cautious brother who can act as a spiritual elder to help us. But I would be amazed if someone can rescue his ship from the open ocean by himself. The same sin can bring a punishment 100 times harsher for one person compared to another, depending on the state, disposition, setting, progress, and many other factors. Once, someone related to me a case involving an exceptionally high level of purity. He told me, a certain man, upon beholding an attractive body, praised the great Creator, and from this one glance, he was brought to a love of God and a spring of tears. It was fantastic to see how something which would have been the ruin of most was for such a one the unnatural occasion of a crown. If a person regularly acts thus and has similar emotions on similar circumstances, then he has risen eternal even before the general resurrection. May we be directed by the same principle in singing songs and hymns. For those that love God are brought to divine merriment, to holy love and to weeping by both worldly and spiritual tunes. But those who love pleasure, the converse is true. As we have discussed previously, some people living as solitaries are subject to much more brutal assaults from their foes. And small wonder, for the demons dwell in such locations. For the Lord, in his concern for our salvation, has pushed them off into the deserts and the depths of hell. The demons of sexual immorality violently attack the hermit in order to force him to return to the world, as if he had derived no benefit from dwelling in the desert. Demons stay away from us while we dwell in the world, so that we may remain conversing with worldly-minded people, for we are not assaulted there. So we should keep in mind that the setting in which we are assaulted in is the location in which we will be battling in a harsh war with the enemy. For if we are not struggling, the enemy is showing us that he is our ally. When we are present in the world for some good cause, we are shielded by the hand of God, perhaps by the prayer of our spiritual father, so that the Lord may not be blasphemed by us. At times we are shielded from harm by our apathy and by having had long exposure to the things present in the world and the topics of discourse and all its other movements. But sometimes it is because the demons withdraw from us of their own will and leave us only the demon of conceit who is able to replace the rest. Listen to yet another scheme and snare of that adversary, all you who desire to be established in chastity, and watch out for it. One who had gained experience dealing with these wiles related to me that the demon of carnality would often hide himself entirely, and during a time when a monk was sitting or chatting with women, he would propose to him great godliness, and maybe even weeping, and would suggest teaching them about the remembrance of death, judgment, and purity. Then, the unfortunate woman, being tricked by his words and fake piety, would rush to this wolf as if to a shepherd. Then, with time, when acquaintance blossomed into closeness, the poor monk would undergo a fall. Let us, by all possible means, keep away from either gazing upon or hearing of that fruit which we have sworn not to partake. It is foolish to suppose that we are better than the prophet David, for that is impossible. Purity deserves such exalted praise that some of the fathers dared to call it independence from passion. There are some who say that those who have tasted sin can never be called pure. To dispute this point, I would say, if someone truly desires it, it is simple enough to graft a good olive branch onto a wild olive tree. But if the keys of heaven had been given to one who had always been chaste, then perhaps those who make such an assertion would be correct. But may they be disgraced by the one who had a mother-in-law and was still pure enough to receive the keys to the kingdom. The serpent of carnality has many faces. With those who lack experience with vice, he plants the thoughts of taking on one ordeal and then ceasing. But this wily foe then suggests to those who have attempted one trial to try yet another by the remembrance of their fall. Many people who lack experience sense no struggle within themselves simply because they cannot discern what is evil. But the experienced, since they are familiar with this abhorrence, endure tribulation and fight. But many times the converse also occurs. When we awake from our sleep in a calm and peaceful mood, we are being privately assisted by the holy angels, in particular if before we went to sleep we prayed and kept vigil. But at times, we awaken being sullen, and this is the consequence of nightmares and fantasies. I have observed the evil in me, lifted up on high and towering above, and raving and frenzied just like the cedars of Lebanon. And as I recovered with moderation, this rage was not there as before, and I made lowly my thoughts and searched for him, and I could not discover his dwelling, not a single mark of it. The one who has overcome his body has overcome nature itself, and the one who has overcome nature has been exalted above nature, and has become a little lower than the angels. It is not extraordinary for the incorporeal to battle with the incorporeal, but it is extraordinary for one clothed in the material and struggling with this antagonistic and wily matter to drive off incorporeal enemies. The good Lord shows his concern for us in that the brazenness of women is moderated by timidness, as if by a bridle. For if women were to chase after men, nobody would be saved. According to the judgment made by the fathers, a distinction is set between various things, such as attraction, or relation, or assent, or enslavement, or striving, or what is known as passion in the soul. And these blessed men define attraction as the imagined image, or likeness which becomes implanted in the heart after being seen for the first time. Relation is conversation with whatever has shown itself, joined with passion or dispassion. And assent is the movement of the soul to whatever has been shown to it, joined with joy. But enslavement is a violent and undesired violation of the heart, or a fixed union with what has been presented to it, which ruins our good estate. Striving, by their definition, in strength equal to the opposing force, which either conquers or succumbs to loss according to the soul's longing. They specify passion in a particular way, as that which hides uneasy in the soul for a period of time, and by its close association with the soul leads it to habit, a self brought on complete abandonment. Among these problems, the first does not have sin, the second sometimes. The third may have sin, depending on the state of the athlete. Striving can lead to crowns or punishments. Enslavement is judged depending on if it happens at the time of prayer or at a different time. It is judged one way in situations which are not as important, and in another way when bad thoughts are involved. However, passion is condemned in every situation and requires either repentance or a change of future behavior. So it is that the one who sees the first attraction dispassionately slices off with a single strike all the others. Among the more exact and wise fathers, there is talk of a more subtle problem. This is a concept which is referred to as a snap of the mind. Its feature is this: without time passing, with no word or image, it suddenly presents a passion to its prey. There is nothing quicker than this in the visible world, or more indistinguishable in the spiritual world. It reveals itself in the soul by a mere remembrance with which the soul lacks the time to dwell on it. Since it does not proceed with time and is not joined to any image, it is impossible to examine, and in certain instances is unknown to the individual. If someone, with the aid of lamentation, is capable of seeing such subtlety, he can detail to us how a soul is capable with only the eye, by a quick glance or a touch with the hand, or when listening to a song or without any concept in the mind, to commit the sin of impurity. There are some who state that passions assault the body from sexually immoral thoughts, but some say the opposite, that bad thoughts come from motions of the body. The first state that if the mind had not first tread the path, the body would never have followed after it. The latter conclude that the animosity of carnal passion supports their theory, stating that many times evil thoughts come into the heart as a consequence of a beautiful sight, or a touch of the hand, or from the fragrance of perfume, or listening to pleasant speech. If someone is able, with the help of the Lord, may he explain this, because to understand these issues is essential and helpful for those abiding in the active life. However, for those that are exercising themselves in virtue with a simple heart, issues like this have no importance, for not everybody has understanding, and neither does everyone have the breastplate of blessed innocence to fight the machinations of the wicked spirits. There are some passions which are able to move from the body to the soul, and others perform the reverse. The latter occurs with people that live in the world, but the first occur only with those dwelling as monks, because of the scarcity of provocations coming from outside the body. Concerning this topic, I will only state, you will seek knowledge from wicked men, and you will not find it. When we have battled a good deal with this demon, who is the partner of vileness, and cast it from our heart, tormenting it with the rock of fasting and the blade of a humble nature, then this vile one, like some sort of worm, conceals itself in our members and attempts to pollute us, tricking us with unseasonable motions. Those who are dominated by the demon of pride especially suffer by this. This occurs when their hearts cease to be regularly concerned with polluted thoughts, so that they become susceptible to the passion of arrogance. To be fully assured of the veracity of what was stated, at the point they have gained a certain degree of pious stillness, let them privately study themselves. Then they will surely discover there are some thoughts which are hidden deep in their heart like a serpent in a pile of manure, hinting that they have advanced in attaining a greater purity of heart through their own toil and labor. Miserable fools, they do not consider the saying, "What have you that you did not receive as a gift either from God or by the help and entreaties of other people?" And thus may they examine their own dealings, and may they toss the serpent spoken of above from their heart in haste, destroying it through a humble nature, so that when they have cast it off, they will remove their outer garment of skin, the passions, and like innocent children, sing to the Lord the victorious song of chastity, only if, when they are exposed, they do not discover they are bare of humility and free from ill will, which is normal for children. This demon, even more than the other ones mentioned, looks for ripe opportunities, and at the moment we are unable to pray in opposition to it, then the ungodly beast strikes up a battle against us. Those who have not been able to attain sincere, heartfelt prayer can find support through violence in prayer with the body. By this I mean extending the hands, striking one's chest, earnestly lifting up one's eyes to the heavens, profound moaning, many prostrations. However, it may be that they are unable to do this because of other people nearby. The demons particularly like to do battle with them in these moments, and since we are not powerful enough to hold them off by strength of the mind and the unseen power of prayer, we surrender to our foes. If you can, remove yourself a certain distance, conceal yourself for a time in some private place, lift up the eyes of your soul, and if you are able, your physical eyes as well. Without letting your arms move, hold them in the form of a cross, so that you might disgrace and overcome your Amalek. Shout to him who is powerful to deliver you. Without subtle words, use a humble entreaty, using this as your introduction. Have mercy on me, because I am feeble. Then you will come to understand by experience the strength of the Most Exalted, and with unseen aids, you will invisibly push back the unseen ones. The one who adapts himself to fight battles by these means will in time be able to rout his enemies purely through spiritual means, for the latter is compensated by God to those who practice the former, and for good reason. In an assembly where I was, I perceived that one of the more eager brothers was being bothered by bad thoughts due to the fact he could not find a good place for private prayer. So he set out, as if physically forced, to a location which was suitable for his aim, and there he prepared himself for battling against the enemy with prayer. When I rebuked him because he chose a filthy location, he answered me, "In a dirty spot, I prayed to banish dirty thoughts in order to be cleansed of all uncleanliness." Every demon will attempt to cloud our mind so as to propose what they want, because so long as the mind does not close its eyes, we will not be plundered of its wealth. But the demon of sexual immorality attempts this more than the others. Many times after clouding our mind, which directs our actions, it suggests and pushes us in the company of others to do those things that only the truly mad do. Then, later on, when the mind is composed, we are very much embarrassed by our vile deeds, speech and motions not only from those who saw us, but also from ourselves, and we are astonished at our former dumbness. Many times, merely by deliberating on their past actions, men have ceased from this vice. Expel the foe when he impedes prayer, contemplation, or watchfulness after you have sinned. Remember the one who said, "Since the soul grieved by the memory of former sins troubles me, I will provide relief from her foes." Who has overcome his carnal nature? It is the one who has broken his heart. And who is the one that has broken his heart? It is he who has denied himself. For how is it possible not to be broken when you have put to death your will? There is a passionate person even more fervent than the passionate, and he will also acknowledge his defilements with joy and delight. Polluted and disgraceful movements of the heart are often formed by the one that tricks the heart, the demon of sexual immorality. But moderation, and simply ignoring them, is the remedy. However, I'm at a loss as to what practice or discipline I can use to shackle this companion. What example from the passions can I use to judge him? Before I can tie him up, he is free, and before I can judge and punish him, we have been reconciled and I have abased myself so that I show mercy to him. How is it possible to detest the one who by nature I love? How am I able to be at liberty from the one to whom I am eternally tied? How can I flee from the one who will be my companion at the resurrection? How can I transform to immortality that which has a mortal nature? What debate can I employ against the one who has the argument of nature? If I should tie him up through fasting, by judging my neighbor, I am delivered to him again. If, holding back from condemning others, I conquer him, then through arrogance on account of this, I am bested by him again. He is both a friend and an enemy, an aid and a foe, a help and a betrayer. If I am good to him, he assaults me. If I wear him out, he gets weak. When he is relaxed, he causes trouble. If I turn to leave in disgust, he will not allow it. If I try to mortify him, I put myself in danger. If I knock him down, then I lack the means for acquiring virtues. I welcome him, and I refuse him. What is this enigma? What is the reason for this mixing of carnal and spiritual? How can I be made up of both an ally and an enemy? Speak to me, my companion, my very nature, for I will not ask anyone else so that I might understand you. How can I continue without being hurt by you? How can I stay away from the hazards of my composition? I have already made an oath with Christ to battle with you. How can I triumph over your rule? For I am determined to be your Lord. And the body may answer the soul, "I will never speak to you of things which you do not know, but instead those things which we both understand. Within is my father, conceit. The flame which I feel from outside comes from pleasing me, and from ease. The flame inside which burns comes from former comforts and actions. Once I have conceived, I breed sins, and when they are born, they give birth to death or despondency. If you prevent your appetite from eating, you have shackled my feet from moving forward. If you are yoked with obedience, you have cast off my yoke. If you become humble, you will strike off my head." This prize is the 15th triumph. The one who has attained it while abiding in the flesh has already died and been resurrected. From here on, he will have a foretaste of the coming immortality. Step 16. On the love of money or greed. Many wise instructors examine next, after the oppressor just mentioned, the thousand-headed devil of greed. As uneducated as we are, we had no desire to alter the ordering of the educated, and so we have used the same custom and rule. Let us speak briefly about this illness, and then cover shortly the cure. Greed, or avarice, is idolatry, the daughter of a lack of faith, a pretext for illness, a forerunner of old age, a prophecy of drought, an announcer of famine. Avarice laughs at the good news and deliberately commits iniquity. He who possesses love disperses his money, but the one who claims that he lives for both love and money has tricked himself. He who grieves over himself has also rejected his body, and when the time calls for it, he does not save it. Never say that you are amassing silver for the poor, because with two mites the kingdom of heaven was bought. A man who was hospitable and an avarice man once met each other, and the latter referred to the other as incomprehensible. The one who has overcome this passion has removed his anxiety, but the one who is joined to it will never achieve purity of prayer. The start of avarice is the excuse of charity, and the completion is a loathing of the poor. As long as he is acquiring, he is generous, but when the silver is in his hand, he stiffens his grip. I have seen how people of meager means profit themselves by dwelling with the meek, and so forgot their initial poverty. A monk who is covetous is a foreigner to being idle, and has a regular remembrance of the saying of the apostle, "Let a lazy man not eat," and also, "These hands of mine have served me and those who accompanied me." The 16th contest. The one who has achieved this triumph has either acquired love or removed concern. Step 17. On poverty. Being poor is to give up anxiety, a life without worry, an unhindered traveler, a stranger of grief, of faithfulness to the commandments. An impoverished monk is a king of the world. He has given over his concerns to God, and through his trust has received all men as his servants. He will not speak of his want to another, and he takes what comes to him as if from the hand of the Lord. The penniless ascetic is the child of detachment, and he regards as nothing the things he has. When he becomes a hermit, he considers all things as dung. If he is concerned about anything, he has not yet achieved poverty. A poor person is spotless when praying, but a greedy man prays to physical images. Those who are under obedience are foreigners to avarice. For when the body has been rejected, what remains for his own? There is only one course by which they are amiss, which is being prepared to quickly leave and travel from one location to another. I have seen material belongings make monks suffer to stay in one location. But I laud those who are vagabonds for the Lord. The one who has enjoyed the exalted things quickly scorns the things below. But the one who has not sampled the things that are above finds delight in material things. A man who makes himself poor for no purpose will suffer two blows. He misses out on present treasures and future ones. Let us monks be then as trusting birds, because they have no concerns and they do not gather. Great is the one who devoutly gives up his material goods, but holy is he who gives up his will. The one will obtain 100-fold more of either money or graces, but the other will inherit everlasting life. Waves cannot abandon the sea, and neither do anger and distress leave the greedy. He who disdains matter has left arguing and disputes, but the greedy man will fight to the death over a needle. Undoubting faith casts off concerns, and remembrance of death refuses the body as well. There was no hint of avarice in Job. So when he lost all his possessions, he continued untroubled. Avarice is called the root of all evil, because it engenders malice, robbery, envy, division, ill will, tribulation, remembrance of injuries, cruelness, and murders. There are some who, with a small fire, have burned a great deal of wood, and some have eluded all of the passions just listed with the aid of one virtue, which is detachment. It is born of experience and from a taste of God, and from pondering on the reckoning to be made at our death. The alert reader will remember the historical account of the mother of evil. When she listed her vile and damned children, she said that her second child was the stone of apathy. However, The many-headed snake of worshipping idols hindered me from giving it its own proper spot, for reasons that elude me. However, the wise fathers set it on the third link of the chain of eight deadly sins. Having spoken enough about the love of money, we purpose now to discuss apathy, the third sickness, even though it was the second child. After this, we will dwell briefly on the topic of sleep and vigil, and also childish and cowardly fear, for these shortcomings belong to beginners. The 17th step. The one who has ascended to it is traveling to heaven, stripped bare of all material possessions. Step 18. On apathy, which is the death of the soul and mind before the death of the body. Apathy in the body and the spirit is a numb feeling, which from a lengthy illness and neglect slips into insensibility. Apathy is neglect that becomes a regular practice, deadening the mind. It is the birth of conjecture, a trap for eagerness, a noose of bravery, an ignorance of remorse, a gateway to depression, the mother of forgetting, which begets a neglect of the fear of God. Then, she incestuously becomes a daughter of her daughter. The one who is apathetic is a philosopher without a brain, a self-damned critic, a hypocritical windbag, a blind man who instructs others how to see. He speaks about curing an injury, but never ceases aggravating it. He protests of an illness, but does not cease eating what is bad. He prays in opposition to it, and then straightaway goes and does the very thing. Then, when he has done it, he is annoyed with himself. The vile man is not embarrassed by his own words. "I am committing sin," he yells, and earnestly continues committing it. His mouth prays in opposition to his vice, and his body fights for it. He philosophizes about the topic of death, but acts as if he were going to live forever. He sighs over the division of the soul and body, but dozes on as if he were endless. He speaks of moderation and temperance, but he lives for the consumption of food. He reads about the final judgment and starts to snicker. He reads about arrogance and is arrogant while reading. He reiterates what he discovered about vigil and then falls asleep immediately. He lauds prayer, but flees from it as if it were the plague. He praises obedience, but he is the first one to disobey. He praises detachment, but he is not embarrassed to be bitter and to struggle for a piece of cloth. When he gets angry, he quickly becomes caustic, and then he is indigent at his caustic nature. He does not sense that after each ruin he is succumbing to another. After he overeats, he repents, but then after a period of time he does the same thing. He praises stillness and then lauds it with a flood of words. He instructs on the topic of humility, and while teaching often becomes angry. Awaking from passion, he groans, and nodding his head, he once again gives into passion. He derides jesting and instructs on lamenting while smiling. In front of others, he reproaches himself for being arrogant, and in reproaching himself, he is only looking for praise for himself. He gazes at the faces of others with passion and speaks about purity of heart. While spending time in the world, he lauds the life of solitude. Without realizing it, he embarrasses himself. He praises charity and disdains beggars. At all times, he is his own adversary, but he has no desire to rouse himself. I will not say he is unable. I have observed numerous people just like this listen to the topic of death and the fearsome judgment and weep, and with teardrops still on their cheeks, they earnestly go their dinner. I was astonished how this oppressor, this skunk of gluttony, by total apathy, can become so powerful as to alter even grief. As much as my ability permits and my understanding allows, I have revealed the tricks and snares of this hard, stony, wild, and idiotic passion. I lack the endurance to expand on the topic. The one who is experienced and capable in the Lord should not hold back from using treatment on their wounds. For I am not embarrassed to acknowledge my own shortcomings, since I am also ill from this disease. I would not have been able to reveal its trickery and subterfuge by myself if I had not seized hold and retained it, investigating it and forcing it to admit to what has been related previously, and flogging it with the whip of the fear of the Lord and incessant prayer. This is the reason why this oppressor and wicked one said to me, "My servants chuckle when they look upon the dead bodies, When they pray, they are stony, rigid, and gloomy. When they look upon the holy altar, they have no feeling. When they participate in the mysteries, it is as if they are consuming regular bread. When I see people moved with remorse, I deride them. From my father, I have learned to destroy all good things which are the offspring of bravery and compassion. I am the mother of jesting, the nursemaid of sleep, the friend of a swollen stomach. When I am revealed, I do not show remorse. I go together with false piety. I was struck by these words of this mad being and inquired about her father, desiring to know her name. And she said, I have no single set of parents. My conception is a blend and not definite. Satiety feeds me. I grow with time and a bad habit secures me. He who maintains this practice will never be free from me. Be regular and vigil, reflecting on the final judgment, then maybe I will, to some degree, release my grip on you. Find out the root cause of me, and then wage war on my mother, for she is not the same in all instances. Frequent the tombs and pray there, and keep the image of them in your heart. But unless you engrave it with the reed pen of fasting, you will never overcome me. Step 19. On sleep prayer and psalmody in church. Sleep is a certain condition of nature, a representation of death, a numbing of the senses. Sleep is singular, but like a passion, its causes and occurrences are manifold. That is to say, it starts from nature, from food, from demons, or sometimes from extended and strict fasting, by which the flesh becomes weak and finally yearns for the comfort of sleep. Just as extended drinking is a custom of habit, so too from habit comes oversleeping. So we must contend with the matter of sleep, most particularly in the easygoing days of obedience, because a habit which is deeply entrenched is difficult to treat. Let us look and we will find that spiritual trumpet which acts as an outward sign of the collecting of the brothers, but is also a sign for the gathering of our enemies. Indeed, there will be some of them who will be present at our bedside, and when we arise, they encourage us to lie back down again. Hold on, they say, until the initial hymns are concluded, then you should go to church. Others plunge those present at prayer into sleep. Some create sharp, bizarre pains in the belly. Others encourage us to talk in the church. Some incite the mind to bad thoughts. Others encourage us to rest against the wall as if we were worn out. At times, they entangle us in bouts of yawning. Some of them produce waves of giggling during the time of prayer with the aim of inciting the anger of God against us. Some compel us to rush through the readings or singing simply from indolence. Others indicate that we should sing more slowly for the enjoyment of it. And at times they sit right on our mouths and close them, so that we are hardly able to open them at all. However, the one who understands that he is standing in the presence of God will be like a post at the time of prayer, and he will pray with profound emotions, and none of the previous mentioned demons will give him trouble. The truly obedient man, often without warning, becomes radiant and lifted up during prayer. This contestant was readied and warmed before by his heartfelt service. Everyone is able to pray with a congregation. For many, it is helpful to pray with just one other companion. Prayer in solitude is possible for only a few. When singing with many people, it is not possible to pray a voiceless prayer of the Spirit. Still, your mind should be attentive in pondering the words being read or chanted, or you should repeat a certain prayer while you are waiting for the next verse to be chanted. It is not fitting for anyone to start doing any alternate work, or rather, engage in a diversion during prayer. For the angel who accompanied Antony the Great instructed him on this clearly. In the same manner that a furnace tries gold, so also the exercise of prayer tries the monk's enthusiasm and love for God. An honorable work. The one who makes it his own draws close to God and drives out the demons. Step 20. On bodily vigil. How to use it to achieve spiritual vigil and how to exercise it. Some are present before earthly kings without arms or armor, others hold a staff of the office, and others have shields, and others swords. The first way is much better than the last, for they are often personally familiar with the king and part of the royal entourage. This is also the case with earthly kings. Now let us examine how we should stand before God our King when we are present during the prayers in the evening or during the day or night. For some people, during the evening all-night vigil, raise their hands in prayer as if they were bodiless and naked of all concern. Others stand during that time singing hymns. Others are more given to reading. And some, from feebleness, bravely withstand sleep by laboring with their hands. Others attempt to feel the terror of death, hoping by so doing to feel remorse. Of all of these, the first and last are an all-night vigil for the love of God. The second, do what is suitable for a monk. The third, go the most basic way. And still, God receives and honors the offerings of each one in accord with their aim and ability. A watchful eye creates a pure mind, but frequent sleep ties up the soul. A watchful monk is an enemy to sexual immorality, but a sleepy one fornicates with it. A vigil extinguishes lust, saves from ghostly dreams. A vigil is a tearing eye, a warm heart, a watch over thoughts, a disinterest in food, a calming of passions, a controlling of spirits, a restraining of the tongue, an expulsion of fantasies. A monk who deprives himself of sleep is a fisher of the mind, and in the quiet of the night, he can easily see and trap them. The monk who loves God says, "Excellent, excellent," when the bell finally rings for prayer. The indolent one says, "What a pain." The setting of the table brings forth the gluttons, but the labor of prayer brings forth the lovers of God. The first prance on beholding the table, but the latter frown. Extended sleep creates forgetfulness, but a vigil cleanses the memory. The profit of the farmer is collected on the threshing floor and with the winepress, but the profit and the wisdom of the monk is collected during the evenings and the nighttime, when present at prayer and active in spiritual work. Extended sleep is an unrighteous ally. It plunders the indolent of half their life, and maybe more. The monk who lacks experience is fully alert in pleasant conversation, but when the time of prayer has come, his eyes become heavy. The indolent monk is well known and skilled at conversation, but when reading is about to start, he can barely keep his eyes open. At the sound of the trumpet, the dead will rise, and when idle conversation is present, those who were asleep become alert. The oppressor, sleep, is a wily companion. When we are satiated with food many times, it departs from us, but at times of hunger and thirst, it assaults us viciously. It asserts that we should perform work with our hands during the time of prayer, for it is unable by other means to disrupt the prayers of the attentive. Initially, it comes to struggle with novices so as to make them careless right from the beginning, or to pave the way for the demon of sexual immorality. Until we are free from this, we should not ask to be excused from the communal service, for many times embarrassment keeps us away from dozing. The dog is the foe of the rabbits, and the demon of pride is the foe of sleep. When the day has finished, the salesman takes a seat and reckons his profit, and the ascetic does the same when the singing of psalms is finished. When prayer is complete, wait attentively, and you will observe that hordes of demons, as if assaulted by us, attempt to overrun us at the end of the prayer with silly fantasies. Sit and attend. You will regard those who are in the practice of seizing the first fruits of the soul. It is possible that regular contemplation on the verses of the Psalms extends into the time of sleep. It may happen that the demons lodge these passages into our mind so as to lead us to vainglory. I would not have spoken about the third instance if someone had not compelled me to do so. The soul which has been engaged the entire day without stopping with the word of the Lord will love to be involved with it when asleep as well. For this second grace is, in a particular way, a prize for the first, and aids us in keeping away from various falls and fantasies. Step 20. He who has ascended to it has brought light into his heart. Step 21. On immature and childish faint-heartedness. If you chase after virtue in a monastery or a community, it is unlikely you will be assaulted a great deal by fear. But the one who dwells in solitary locations should strive to avoid being overtaken by that child of pride and daughter of disbelief, cowardice. A lack of courage in an immature disposition in an aged, prideful soul. Faint-heartedness is a lack of faith that is a result of expecting the unexpected. Being afraid is the practice of danger before it happens. Or another way, Fear is a quivering feeling of the heart, anxious and worried by unknown dangers. Fear is the loss of resolve. A vainglorious soul is a servant of faint-heartedness. In vain, it relies on itself, and it is afraid of any sound or shadow of other beings. Those who grieve for their sins are unaffected by other griefs and are insensible to faint-heartedness, but those that lack courage frequently have mental breakdowns. But this is rather natural, for the Lord justly forsakes the haughty, so that the rest of us will be instructed not to be proud. Even though all faint-hearted people are proud, yet not all who have courage are meek, since even thieves and grave robbers are often without fear. Do not falter to go late in the night to those locations where you normally feel afraid. But if you surrender only a small degree to such weakness, then this immature and foolish sickness will age with you. As you go through life, equip yourself with prayer. When you arrive at your destination, stretch out your hands, scourge your enemies with the name of Jesus, for there is no weapon more powerful in heaven or on earth. When you are free from the pestilence of fear, glorify Him who has saved you. If you persist in being grateful, He will forever guard you. In the same way that it is impossible to gratify the belly in one sitting, so it is impossible to conquer fear immediately. It will surrender only to the measure of your grieving. But to the degree that our lamentation fails, we persist in being cowardly. "My hair and my body trembled," said Eliphaz, when he described the animosity of the demon. Sometimes the soul and sometimes the body become cowardly first, and one infects the other with its illness. If this inopportune fear does not infect the soul when the body winces, then the disease is close to being cured. True liberty from fear comes when we earnestly receive all the unseen events in our life with a penitent heart. It is not due to a location being gloomy and solitary that demons gain power over us, but through emptiness of soul. And through God's providence this occurs, so that we may be instructed by it. The one who has become the Lord's servant will fear only his master, but the one who is not yet afraid of him frequently is frightened by his own shadow. The body becomes afraid when it is in the presence of an invisible spirit. However, when it is in the presence of an angel, the soul of the humble one is filled with delight. So when we perceive the presence by the effect it has, let us hasten to prayer, because our fair guardian angel has come to pray with us. The one who has overcome fear has certainly devoted his body and soul to God. Step 22. On the Manifold Nature of Vainglory. Some people make a distinction between vainglory and pride, and would assign it its own section. Such would assert there are 8 principal and deadly sins. However, Gregory the theologian and other teachers have listed only 7, and I am inclined to agree. For who has overcome vainglory and still has pride? The distinction between them is as between a youth and a man, or between flour and bread. For one is the beginning, and the other is the end. So now that the opportunity presents itself, let us cover the beginning and the end of the passions, that unholy self-respect. For if someone were to attempt to philosophize in detail on this topic, he would be like one who argues about the weight of the winds. Concerning the form, vainglory is an alteration of nature, a corruption of character, a point of reproach. And regarding its quality, it is a waste of work, a squandering of sweat, a loss of wealth, a child of disbelief, the beginning of pride, a shipwreck in the harbor, an ant on the threshing floor, which, even though it is small, it has plans for taking all one's toil and goods. The ant awaits the harvest of the wheat, and vainglory waits for the collection of the wealth of virtue. For one delights in stealing and other in spending. The spirit of depression delights at the sight of growing sin, and the spirit of vainglory at the sight of the growing wealth of virtue. The gateway of the first is an abundance of injuries, and the gateway to the second is a treasure of toils. Look, and you will discover profane vainglory growing up to the very tomb in garments, oils, slaves, perfumes, and similar such items. The sun shines its rays on everyone, and vainglory shines on all undertakings. For example, I am vainglorious when I fast, and I am vainglorious again over my discretion when I ease the fast trying to remain unseen. When I am nicely dressed, I am conquered by vainglory. and when I put on ragged old clothing, I am again vainglorious. When I converse, I am conquered, and when I am quiet again, I am conquered. No matter how I toss this prickly pear, at least one thorn stands upright. A person that is vainglorious is a faithful idolater. He seems to honor God, but he desires to please men and not God. Everyone who engages in attention-seeking behavior is vainglorious. The fast of the vainglorious has no merit, and his prayer is useless because he performs both for the praise of men. An ascetic who is vainglorious is deceived twice. He tires his body, and he receives no recompense. Who cannot chuckle at the vainglorious laborer who is present at psalmody and is stirred by one passion to laughter and then to weeping for everyone to see? Many times God covers from our sight excellences which we have achieved, but he who honors us, or, I should say, deceives us, opens our eyes through this acclaim, and once our eyes are opened, our wealth disappears. The one who flatters you is a slave of demons, an escort to pride, a wrecker of remorse, a destroyer of virtues, a deceiver. Those who praise you mislead you, says the prophet. People with a lofty spirit take disdain honorably and willingly, but only truly devout and holy people receive praise without injury. I have observed people grieving who, when honored, rose up in anger, and as if at a communal gathering, one passion gave way to another. Who among men knows the thoughts of a man, except the spirit that abides within the man? So let those who attempt to honor us to our face be quiet and disgraced. When you hear that your friend or neighbor has slandered you behind your back or even in your presence, then exhibit love for him and honor him. It is a good deed to shake off the honor of men from your soul, but to reject the glory of demons is even better. It is not the one who belittles himself who displays humility, but the one who gives the same love to the person who reviles him. I have observed the demon of vainglory offering thoughts to one brother while he shows them to another, and he induces the latter to reveal to the first what is in his mind, and then glorifies him as a mind reader. And at times, that vile creature even touches the members of the body and produces sensations. Do not be concerned about him when he asserts that you should become a bishop or an abbot or a doctor, for it is hard to repel a dog from the butcher's shop. When he observes that any have obtained, to some small degree, a contemplative disposition, he quickly suggests that they forsake the desert for the world, saying, "Depart from here to rescue the souls which are falling away." Ethiopians have one type of face, and statues have another. So, too, the vainglory of those abiding in a community have a different figure compared to those who abide in the desert. Vainglory urges monks who enjoy lightheartedness to wait for guests to arrive and then to leave the cloister to greet them. It urges them to prostrate before them, and even though replete with pride, it fakes humility. It looks at the attitude and voice and maintains an eye on the hands of the guests so as to receive something from them. It uses the names, lords and patrons, which are full of godliness. To those reclining at the table, it urges abstinence, and it censures servants without mercy. It moves those who are lazy when standing up in psalmody to put forth an effort, and those who lack a voice to become good singers, and the tired to become alert. It lauds the conductor and requests to be allowed the primary position in the choir. It refers to him as father and master while the visitors are still present. Vainglory makes proud those who are favored, but it makes resentful those who are disregarded. Vainglory brings disgrace instead of honor, since it creates dishonor for its angry disciples. Vainglory makes hot-tempered people mild before others. It has a high aspirations for natural gifts, and by means of them often throws its unhappy servants to their ruin. I have observed a demon hurt and driven off his own brother, for just at the point a brother had become angry, guests suddenly appeared, and the vile offender resold himself to vainglory. He was not able to serve two passions at the same time. He who has become a slave to vainglory has a double life. In appearance, he dwells with monks, but in his mind, he is in the world. If we earnestly long to please the heavenly King, we should be zealous to partake of the heavenly glory. The one who has partaken will reject all earthly glory. I would be surprised if anyone could reject the latter unless he had partaken of the first. Many times after being divested by vainglory, we turn and expose it more skillfully. I have observed some who started spiritual works on account of vainglory, and even though they had a foul start, their end was honorable because their motive changed. The one who is boastful about his natural gifts, by which I mean skill, ability to master material, talent in reading, a good pronunciation, keen intelligence, and all such talents received from us without effort, never will receive heavenly blessings, since he who is unfaithful with a few things is also unfaithful and prideful with many. For the benefit of great dispassion, rich talents, miracle working, and the ability to prophesy, many people wear out their bodies to no effect. They do not understand, poor fools, that it is not by labor as much as by humility, which is the mother of such virtues. The one who requests gifts from God in exchange for his effort has set an unstable foundation. The one who thinks himself an unworthy debtor will hastily and without warning obtain wealth. Do not trust the winnower when he urges you to show your virtues for the instruction of those who hear. For what will a man gain if he should bring benefit to the entire world and forgo his own soul? There is nothing which so instructs our neighbor as an honest and humble demeanor and speech, for this acts as a goad to others not to be arrogant. And what can be more helpful than this? One who possessed the gift of foresight once related to me what he had observed. At one time, he said, when I was present in the assembly, the demon of vainglory and the demon of pride came to me and sat down on either side of me. One prodded me on my side with the finger of vainglory and suggested that I tell of some vision or deed which I had accomplished in the desert. But when I had driven him off, telling him, "Let them be confounded and set at naught who devise evil against me," then the demon on my other side immediately told me, "Good job, good job. You have become excellent at overcoming my brazen mother." Turning to him, I used the rest of the verse and said, "Let them be confounded and put to shame that say, 'Well done, well done.'" And as for my question, "How is vainglory pride's mother?" he answered, "Glory lifts up and inflates, and when the soul is lifted up, then pride grabs hold of it, lifting it up to heaven and then throwing it down to the abyss. There is honor that comes from the Lord, for he says, 'Those who honor me, I will honor.' And there is honor that is offered to us by means of diabolic tricks, for it is written, 'Woe to you when all men speak well of you.' You may be confident that it is the first type of honor when you see it is hurtful, and keep away from it by all means, and keep secret your way of life wherever you travel. But the other will be clear to you when you do something, however insignificant, and then have the desire to be seen by others. Vile vainglory compels us to imagine that we possess some virtue that we do not have, urging us on by the words, 'Let your light so shine before others that they may see your good deeds.' The Lord frequently leads those who are vainglorious to a position of meekness by means of disgrace. The start of overcoming vainglory is the imprisonment of the mouth and the love of dishonor. The middle stage is the driving back of every possible deed of vainglory. And the end, if the abyss has a bottom, involves attempting to act in the presence of others so that we are humiliated without actually feeling it. Do not cover up your sins with the notion of removing a stumbling block from your neighbor. Although it is not recommended to apply this treatment in every situation, but it will vary given the character of one's sins. When we summon honor, or when it arrives uninvited from others, or for the sake of vainglory we resolve to follow a particular course of action, we should remember our lamentation, and we should consider the holy fear with which we stand before God in prayer alone. By these means we will surely put rude vainglory out of our presence, if we are indeed interested in how to achieve pure prayer. If this is not enough, then we should quickly recall our end. And if this also does not work, then let us at least fear the embarrassment that comes from honor. For the one who elevates himself will be humbled, not only there, but indeed here also. When our flatterers or our tempters bring glory upon us, let us quickly bring to mind our many sins, and we will discover ourselves not worthy of such praise, either in word or deed. Certainly there are some prayers of vainglorious people that merit being heard by God. But the Lord has the practice of knowing their prayers beforehand, so that their arrogance should not be inflated because their prayers have prevailed. Those who are simple are not as contaminated with the venom of vainglory, for vainglory is the loss of simplicity and a false manner of life. Many times it happens that when a worm is fully grown, it acquires wings and lifts itself up high. So also when vainglory grows, it begets pride, the start and the maturity of all evil. He who lacks this illness is close to salvation, but the one who is not at liberty from it is distant from the glory of the saints. The 22nd step. The one who is not seized by vainglory cannot fall into that vile pride which is so detestable to God. Step 23. A. On absurd pride, and also on polluted profane thoughts. Pride is apostasy, a creation of the devil, the disdain of others, the mother of condemning others, the child of praise, a mark of barrenness, a departure from divine aid, the forerunner of craziness, the messenger of missteps, a foothold for being possessed by Satan, a wellspring of anger, a gateway to hypocrisy, the foundation of demons, the assistant of vice, the benefactor of being sympathetic, a denial of mercy, an angry interrogator, a ruthless judge, an adversary of God, a root of blasphemy. The beginning of pride is the maturation of vainglory. The middle involves humiliating our neighbor, the shameless exhibition of our toils, self-satisfaction of the heart, disdain of being exposed. The end is the refusal of help from God, the praising of one's labors, a diabolic nature. May all of us who desire to keep away from this abyss take heed. This passion finds sustenance in gratitude, for in the beginning it does not brazenly suggest we forsake God. I have observed people who praise God with their mouth, but in their mind they glorify themselves. This is validated by the Pharisee, who prayed ironically, "God, I thank you." At the place where a fall has overcome us, pride is there with a tent set up, because a fall is a mark of pride. An honorable man told me, "Imagine that there are 12 disgraceful passions. If we intentionally love one of them, pride, it will occupy the space of the other 11. An arrogant monk will argue forcefully, but one that is humble is unable to even look another in the eye. The cypress tree does not stoop down to dwell on the ground, and neither does a haughty monk to obtain obedience. A prideful person takes hold of authority, since he cannot or indeed does not wish to be completely lost. God opposes the haughty. Who then will have pity for them? Every haughty person is polluted before God. Who can purify such a person? The proud are rectified by falling into sin. It is the devil who goads them on. But apostasy is insanity. In the first two instances, people have many times been cured by others, but the last is not treatable. The one who rejects a rebuke displays his passion, pride, but the who allows it is free from this chain. An angel fell from heaven having no other passion with the exception of pride, and so we may inquire, if it is possible to ascend to heaven through a humble nature alone without having the other virtues. Pride is a privation of treasure and toil. They called out, but no one was there to save, doubtlessly because they called out with pride. They called to the Lord, and he did not listen to them, doubtlessly because they did not attempt to remove the vices against which they were praying. A well-educated old man spiritually disciplined a proud brother, but in his blindness he said, "Pardon me, Father. But I'm not proud." The wise man replied, "What clearer evidence of this very passion could you have provided us, son, than to state, 'I am not proud'?" Some people are able to profit from a submissive, strict, and humiliating life, and also by the reading of the miraculous deeds of the fathers. But even with these, there is scant hope of salvation for those who are afflicted by this illness. It is disgraceful to be proud of the graces of others and completely foolish to think one deserves the graces of God. Only be elevated by such talents as you had before you were born. But what you received after you were born, and even your birth itself, God bestowed upon you. You have only acquired those virtues that did not require your mind, because your mind was provided to you from God, and you have only obtained those achievements by yourself if they did not involve your body. Because your body is not your own, but is the work of God. Never be overly confident until you hear the final judgment against yourself, keeping in mind the wedding guest who made it as far as attending the wedding. But then he was tied up, hand and foot, and cast into the outer darkness. Do not raise your neck, you animal of the earth. For there are many who, even though holy and spiritual, were thrown out of heaven. When the demon of pride gets a footing with his servants, he reveals himself to them either when they are asleep or through a vision when they are awake, taking the form of an angelic being or a martyr, and he provides them with a revelation of mysteries or of a freely given spiritual grace, so that the miserable ones are tricked and totally lose their minds. Even if we were to go through 1,000 deaths for Christ, we would not be able to pay back all that we owe him. For the blood of God is one thing, and the blood of his servants something very different. Here I am reflecting on the dignity and not on the purely physical matter. We must regularly study and contrast ourselves with the holy fathers and the luminaries that have gone before us, and we will then discover that we have not yet started on the path of the ascetic life, nor have we maintained our oath in a noble manner, and in temperament it is as if we are still dwelling in the world. A monk, correctly speaking, is one whose soul's eye does not cast a proud look, and whose bodily senses are indifferent. A monk is one who summons his enemies to war like vicious animals, and annoys them as they run away from him. A monk experiences unremitting rapture of mind and grief of life. A monk is one who is nourished by virtues, as others are by the comforts of life. A monk has unending light in the eye of the heart. A monk has a depth of humility into which he dove and drowned every wicked spirit. Forgetting our sins is the consequence of arrogance, for the memory of them leads to a humble nature. Pride is a complete poverty of the soul under the delusion of wealth, supposing there to be light in its darkness. The vile passion not only hinders our progress, but even casts us down from our heights. The haughty man is a pomegranate, rotten on the inside, while radiantly beautiful on the outside. A haughty monk does not need a demon. He is turned into a demon and foe for himself. Darkness is alien to light, and a haughty person is alien to all virtues. Blasphemous words are born in the heart of a haughty person, but in humble souls, heavenly meditations are born. A robber hates the sun, just as a proud person has contempt for the meek. I do not understand how it is, but those that are haughty generally are completely ignorant of their true nature. They suppose that they are overcoming their passions, but they only understand their impoverishment when they depart from this life. The one entangled in pride will require the aid of God, for the salvation of men cannot help him. At one time I perceived this crazy impostor as it was ascending in my heart carrying its mother, vainglory, on its shoulders. Tying them up with the noose of obedience and beating them with the cords of humility, I insisted on knowing how they were able to enter me. Finally, when whipped, they said, "We do not have a starting point or a birth, for we are the source of all the passions. Repentance of the heart that is born from obedience is our real foe, and we cannot stand to be in submission to anyone. That is the reason we fell from heaven, even though we had power there. In short, we are the parents of all that is in opposition to a humble nature, for everything which advances humility opposes us. Our authority reaches to everything under heaven, so where will you flee from our presence? We frequently accompany long-suffering under disgrace, and obedience, and liberty from anger, want of animosity, and assistance of one's neighbor. Our children are the sins of those who are spiritual. Anger, slander, ill will, peevishness, yelling, blasphemy, hypocrisy, hate, envy, arguing, self-command. There is only one matter in which we have no ability to interfere, and we will tell you about this, for we cannot take your beating. If you maintain a true condemnation of yourself before the Lord, you can be sure that we will be feeble as a spider web. For the saddle horse of pride is vainglory on which I have mounted, but devout humility and self-condemnation scorn both the horse and its rider, gladly singing the tune of triumph. Let us praise the Lord, for gloriously he has been glorified, horse and rider. He has thrown into the sea and abyss of humility. The 23rd step. The one who mounts it, if he is able, will be powerful, Step 23. B. About unspeakable blasphemous thoughts. We know that from an irritating root and mother is born a rather annoying child. That is to say, unmentionable blasphemy is born from vile pride. So it is important to reveal it, since it is no common creature, but the most wicked of all our enemies. And what is even more problematic, it is hard to write, admit, or reveal these thoughts to a spiritual doctor. And thus this unrighteous illness has engendered annoyance and misery in many, killing all their hope, just as a worm in a tree. At the time of the Holy Liturgy, during the time when the mysteries are being completed, this foul foe many times blasphemes the Lord and the holy affairs that are being accomplished. This displays vividly that it is not our own soul that speaks these unmentionable, impious, and inconceivable words within us, but the enemy who hates God, who ran away from heaven for speaking blasphemies against the Lord. Because if these disgraceful and horrendous words belong to me, how could I give glory after partaking of the gift? How can I praise and slander at the same moment? This trickster and polluter of souls has often made many people go crazy. No other movement of the mind is so troublesome to speak about in confession than this one. That is why it often stays with many people until the very conclusion of their life. For there is nothing that offers demons and evil thoughts such authority over us as feeding and concealing them in our heart unconfessed. There is no one in the presence of blasphemous thoughts that need suppose he is liable, for the Lord is the knower of hearts, and he knows that such words and notions are not from us, but from our enemies. Being drunk is a source of falls, and pride is the source of bad thoughts. As far as falls are concerned, the drunk is not the one to blame, but he will surely be punished for being drunk. When we are present in prayer, those polluted and unmentionable thoughts attack us. But if we persist in praying to the end, they withdraw immediately, for they will not battle with those who stand up against them. The impious enemy not only blasphemes against God and everything that is holy, but speaks the most terrible and vile words inside our minds to compel us either to renounce praying or lose hope. He has stopped many people from praying and pulled away many from the holy mysteries. This wicked and cruel oppressor has exhausted the bodies of some with remorse and worn out still others with fasting and has allowed them no repose. He does this with those who live in the monastery as well as with those that dwell in the world, proposing that there is no hope of salvation for them and affirming that they are more pitiful and miserable than all the unbelievers and pagans. The one who is disturbed by the spirit of blasphemy and would like to be rescued from it should understand that it is not his own soul that is the source of such thoughts, but the corrupt demon who said once to the Lord, "All these things I will give you if you bow down and worship me." And thus let us humiliate him as well and not give heed to his implications. Tell him, "Get behind me, Satan. I will worship the Lord my God, and him only I will serve. Your deeds and your word will come back upon your head, and your blasphemies will come down on your crown in the present and in the coming world. Amen." He who desires to struggle with the demon of blasphemy by any other means is like a man attempting to take hold of lightning with his hands. How can you grasp or struggle and grip one who suddenly explodes into the heart like a rush of wind, speaking words faster than lightning and then suddenly disappears? All other foes will pause, struggle, tarry, and give time for those who desire to wrestle with them. But not so with this one. He has only just appeared, and then he vanishes. He has barely said one word, and he is gone. Many times this demon enjoys haunting the minds of simple and pure people, and they are more troubled and struck by it than others. We can surely say of them that all this occurs to them not from self-regard, but from the jealousy of the demons. We should cease condemning and judging our neighbor, and then blasphemous thoughts will not trouble us, for the first is the occasion and the beginning of the latter. Just as one who is confined in his house hears the speaking of those going by without participating in their discussion, so the soul abides in private, and when it overhears devilish blasphemies, it is disturbed by what is said by the demon going by. The one who hates this enemy is saved from its torture, but the one who comes up with some other means to attack it will finish by giving in to it. He who desires to overcome this spirit by speaking is like someone attempting to shut up the winds.